Do you want to talk today about Sharia and renewal, or Sharia and democracy? Like the renewal of the deen, the concept of the renewal of the deen, or Sharia and democracy? Anyone? Democracy? Renewal of Sharia or Sharia and democracy? Renewal, tajdeed. Okay. Okay, well, let's do renewal of Sharia. Well, we'll talk about Sharia and democracy next time, inshallah. Next time will be Sharia and democracy. So, the... We'll talk about Sharia and democracy next time, and inshallah we'll have all the discussion. So, renewal of Sharia. What is the concept itself? A valid concept to renew the deen. Is it a valid concept? Renewal of the deen, renewal of the shara, renewal of the sharia. You're giving good in this.
Yes, in the like the fifth part of it, the transaction, but no in the creed.
Well, if you step back a little bit, I understand that yes, in the fiqh part and the transactions, there is flexibility, there is change, and so on. But what do we mean by renewal? You know, from a conceptual viewpoint, Now, the Prophet ﷺ, as reported by Al-Hakim and Abi Dawood, said, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَبْعَثُ لِهَذِهِ الْأُمَّةِ عَلَىٰ رَأْسِ كُلِّ مِئَةِ عَامٍ مَنْ يُجَدِّدُ لَهَا دِينَهَا. Allah will send for this nation every 100 years someone to renew its deen for it, to renew the deen for this ummah. So, no one can say that this very statement is wrong, renewing the deen. Because who said it? Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the Prophet, he is the one who said it. So he can't say it's wrong as a statement to begin with. Now the discussion will have to do with what? What do you mean by renewal? So what is, what kind of renewal? What is to be renewed, and how do you renew it? And keep in mind that this is really not straightforward. And it is not a simple rule that will help you sort out what to renew and what not to renew and how to renew, etc. It has to do with the whole deen and the whole understanding of the deen. Now, one hadith that is quite important to be put against the first one for balance is what? Which hadith will balance out that first one that we mentioned? Hadith that's reported by Abu Dawood and Hakim from Abi Huraira. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَبْعَثُ لِهَذِهِ الْأُمَّةِ عَلَىٰ رَأْسِ كُلِّ مِئَةِ عَامٍ مَنْ يُجَدِّدُ لَهَا دِينَهَا. There is a hadith that will balance this one out. What is that? Krishna is a stronger one. Tarakta fiko man from a sectum diyavanta vindo bhavi yavada, kidavallahi usanati. I leave amongst you that which, if you hold on to them, you will never go astray after me. The book of Allah and my sunnah. But that doesn't really, where is a stronger one? اليوم أكملت لكم دينكم وأتممت عليكم نعمتي ورضيت لكم الإسلام دينا. Today I have completed your deen for you and perfected my favor upon you and chose Islam for you as your religion. But there is a hadith that is even, clearer as an antidote to the misunderstanding of the first hadith, not to the correct understanding, because the hadith do not conflict with one another. Hadith of من أحدث في أمرنا هذا ما ليس منه فهو رد. Hadith is reported by Bukhari and Muslim from Aisha radiallahu anha. He who innovates in this affair of ours that which doesn't belong to it shall be rejected. So how do you renew the deen without introducing anything new? Thank you. That's one of the answers. That is one answer. So the renewal of the deen, it is actually three-pronged concept, the concept of renewal. One of them is tanqiyah, which is to weeding out, meaning, you know how the weeds grow amongst the good plants, the healthy crops. You have weeds that grow in their midst. So don't the farmers need every once in a while to weed out the field? So to pick the weeds out would be renewal. So when people start to deviate and start to innovate, if someone comes and brings them back to the first point, which is the deen that was revealed and practiced by the first generation, when someone brings them back to that point and removes the innovations and corruptions and misunderstandings and misconceptions away from the deen, he's weeding out the field. So he's renewing the deen, and actually that allows the plants to grow. If you don't have weeds, the plants will grow and prosper. Okay, so that's one concept. What's the other one? You're alluding to it, and I would consider it to be a correct answer. Because the second concept is ihya, that is revival, that is breathing life back into sunan that have been abandoned, or practices that have been neglected by the latter generations. So tanqiyah would be, tanqiyah is to weed out, is to purify, remove all the additions. And ihya, revival, is to bring to life, to bring back to life, sunnah that has died out. A sunnah that has died out. For instance, like in Egypt, when I was a child, no one used siwak. You know siwak? It's the stick, the rock stick. And a lot of people use it. So The idea here is brushing your teeth in the morning with a toothbrush is considered to be siwak, and it's considered to be recommended because siwak is the act of brushing. But the use of this particular stick is helpful because it enables you to brush more than once or twice a day. It enables you to brush with, listen to the Prophet ﷺ and say, had I not feared hardship for my ummah, I would have commanded them to make siwak with every prayer. You can't brush and do this with every prayer. It will actually get rotten unless you wash it. But the stick, that stick is losing its rot. So when someone, you know, brings this back into life or practice, That's a very small example, but there are many other examples. Like when you have one of the bigger examples is to choose your ruler by the will of the people. Wasn't this the sunnah during the time of the Prophet ﷺ? Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman and Ali is choosing the ruler through the people. The people are the ones that choose the ruler. Because as Imam Taymiyyah, Allah so mercy on him, said that Umar did not become a Khalifa when Abu Bakr recommended him to the Khilafah, but he became a Khalifa when the Muslims thereafter accepted Abu Bakr's recommendation. So the ruler is chosen. The same happened with Umar radiallahu anhu. Who recommended six, and it was the Muslims who were pulled and surveyed and asked of their opinions. At the time, there were no glass boxes, and there were no election stations, nowhere in the world. But the Muslims were asked and surveyed, and Abdurrahman ibn Auf took it to a great extent to knock on the doors and to ask the girls and older women in their homes which Khalifa they want, which one of the two, Uthman and Ali, which was the, eventually the sixth came down to Uthman versus Ali, and Allah would be pleased with all of them. So to bring this back into life, that's revival, right? You know, so from the siwak, which is a very small thing, to something as big as this, that is to bring back certain sunan and ways of the Prophet and clear instructions of the revealed religion into life. That's called revival. So we have purification and we have revival. To purify, remove all the additions. Some of the additions also could be people's customs. Because when the religion mixes with people, you know, when the religion gets accepted by people, people's customs will affect to a certain extent how the religion is practiced. Some of this effect may be positive, some of it may be negative. Like when Islam entered Egypt, there is a difference between Islam and Christianity and Islam and other religions, and the fact that Islam really doesn't bend backward for any customs. Yet, as a religion, the religion does not allow customs to invade it, to corrupt it. The religion stays the same, but the people's practice and understanding of the religion will be affected by the previous customs. And that can carry on for centuries and centuries. Don't you have traces of Hinduism in some of the subcontinent's practice of Islam? You do. Don't you have traces of ancient Egyptian culture and the Egyptian people's practice of Islam? You do. And it continues up until now. Like, for instance, when African Americans accept Islam in large numbers, there is no way that they will completely as a people. Some of them will certainly be able to be all about Islam, all Islam, you know. But as a collectively as a people, they may not be able to completely dissociate themselves from their former culture. So therefore, they will bring in some things, like the you know, Hindu pact. When they entered into Islam, they brought in some things, and you know, Egyptians and rest of Africa, depending on the culture, everybody brought in his own little thing. The Iranians, the Persians, they brought in their stuff. In the practice, every place, you know. Well, those are all African. Yeah. So, like anything that is new that you're not really familiar with, like if you are from Somalia and you go to Egypt and you find something that is practiced by the people that you're not really familiar with, you will suspect first pre-Islamic culture as a reason. Like in Egypt, for instance, we have like this occasion of mourning, the mourning after 40 days. That's an old ancient Egyptian practice to mourn the deceased after 40 days. Because in the ancient Egyptian religion, 40 days marked a certain milestone in the life in the grave. Now, it could become a practice in Egypt and can spread to other places. You know, it can be incorporated into Islam in Egypt, and then, you know, people come and study at the Al-Azhar, and they find the Egyptians do this, and they go back home and they tell the people, you know, they are as hairy as now, so they have to do everything right. So that would be one of the things that they bring back home, for instance. Stuff like this happens. Okay. So then renewal does not have to do only with ibadat, with transactions, because most of the renewal that we talked about here, which is revival of certain sunan or Islamic practices and purification, weeding out certain misconceptions, certain innovations, certain customs from prior to Islam that made their way into people's practice, not their religion itself. Because their religion itself, as we said, refused to bend the backwards. Versus when Christianity, you know, went into Asia Minor and they found Hera to be the major god and Zeus to be the major goddess and Hercules to be the half-human, half-divine, and they tailored another trinity after that trinity that was known at the time from Greek mythology, Hera, Zeus, and Hercules. The major god, the major goddess, and the half-human, half-divine, which is Hercules. But Islam refused to do this, yet the people's practice is not immune. You know, their religion is immune, but the people's practice is not immune. So that's why tajdeed or renewal, most of it is through revival of practices that died out, and purification, as you know, of the deed from practices that were innovated, customs that got, you know, incorporated into it, or certain types of deviations, or in general. Is that all the tajdeed? There's what? Yeah, but what's the third? You know, I said three, but that's the third. It's not necessarily a transaction, but the third is the so-called tajdid ijtihadi. We said ihya revival, tanqiya purification, revival purification. But the deen does not change, right? Doesn't change. Tajdid ijtihadi, which is new ijtihad. New ijtihad, that is when you start to get into that is not wrong, that is right. There is a need for tajdid ijtihad, renewal of ijtihad, this new ijtihad in the understanding of the deen. But that is more subtle and more dangerous waters. Therefore, the ones that are allowed to sail in those waters are the most qualified scholars and mujtahideen of the time. Because otherwise, if all of us, roll up our sleeves and start to make the tajdid ijtihadi and have new ijtihad in various matters, then it will be disastrous and the deen will be completely corrupted. So that particular area, but all of us can renew the deen, by the way, because the right understanding of this hadith is that it is not one individual that renews the deen. Because when the Prophet ﷺ says, "In Allah yab'athu li hadhihi al-umma man," Allah will send to this ummah I translated it as someone. The translation should have been, who will renew its deen for it? Because someone means it's one person. But in truth, the correct understanding of the hadith that it is not one person. It is a lot of people. And it could be 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 1,000, 1,500. Could be a lot of people that renew the deen. More. So, and that is, almost a given. The first century, the one who was called Mujaddid for the first century, and was considered by many scholars to be the real Mujaddid, the one Mujaddid, was who? Umar ibn Abdulaziz. Imam Ahmad was born 164 after Hijra. So the first century, Umar ibn Abdulaziz, his Khilafah actually came around the turn of the first Hijri century. And why Umar ibn Abdulaziz would take, that position and no one after him? People did not really agree on naming anyone after him. Because of the expected great results you get from a great scholar and pious man being the Khalifa, the ruler. So, Jumi'a lahu al-Qur'an was Sultan. Two things were combined for him. Al-Qur'an was Sultan. Authority, power, rulership, Sultan. Al-Qur'an. So both were combined. And they rarely get combined for someone after the rightly guided Khalifas, the four Khalifas. So, since he had them both, he was capable of making enormous changes that resulted in people calling him the Mujaddid of the first century. The second century, some people, those who loved Imam Shafi'i so much, they said it was Imam Shafi'i. But there was really no agreement amongst the scholars, unlike Umar ibn Abdulaziz at the end of the first century, there was not an agreement amongst the scholars on Sakai at the end of the second century, because it was really crowded, you know, in a good sense, where a lot of luminaries, a lot of great imams, a lot of great leaders and imams, and so it was very hard to give it to someone. Okay. So we all condemn Mujahideen because the correct understanding of the hadith is that it is not one person. But we all condemn Mujahideen of the first and the second types, revival of practices that died out and purification of the deen from practices that have been added to it. The third one, which is new ijtihad, is reserved, you know, for the best and most capable of the scholars. Not even all the scholars. The best and most capable of the scholars. What is it like, you know, to make a new ijtihad? How do you make a new ijtihad? Why do you need to make a new ijtihad? Yes, thank you. That is one end of it, one side of it, which is the easier one. You still need new matters, like newly emergent matters, such as credit cards, in vitro fertilization, or test tube babies, cloning, you know, various forms of surgery, these DNA testing to prove parenthood, things like this. Don't they need new ijtihad? Because, you know, the four imams did not really address those issues. And the scholars before them and the scholars after them did not address those issues. So you need new ijtihad. But this will be reserved for the best and most capable. Okay. So that is the easier one. Most people agree on this one too. Because you do need an ijtihad for those issues. Yes?
I think the other one is, besides the one that Abraham
said. Yeah, those are the characteristics of the people who would make the ijtihad. But what is the other type of ijtihad that will be considered a renewal? That is not about newly emergent matters. It's about matters that have been there forever. Why do you need new ijtihad for matters that have been there forever? Let's take some examples. When Umar ibn Khattab radiallahu anhu you know, conquered and captured Iraq, Sham, Greater Syria, Egypt, parts of Iran, parts of the southern USSR states, all simultaneously, by the way. He was sending, you know, troops to knock down the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire at the same time. Simultaneously. When he did this, they were able to capture all this land, right? Isn't captured land divided between the conquerors? Captured property is divided between the conquerors, because Ghana and war booty are halal in Islam. They have been halal also within certain restrictions before. But war booty is halal. So don't you divide the property between the conquerors? Well, that is what Sayyidina Bilal said. And Sayyidina Omar refused. And that is the big, disputation that took place between Sayyidina Abu Bakr and Sayyidina Umar, and some people, you know, the Shia, because they try to accuse Umar of each and every evil in the world, they actually make it a matter of racism, which is quite, it's just quite a lie. Sayyidina Abu Bakr wanted this whole land to be divided between the conquerors, because he took a more literalist application of the Sunnah. Sayyidina Umar said that if we divide this between the conquerors, this will result in very few people owning too much land, passing it on to the to their descendants. So you find at the end a little boy or a child having thousands of acres, and a lot of Muslims have nothing. You know, all the Muslims that will come thereafter will have nothing. You know, we're talking now about what? Dividing the land of Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, Iran, Uzbekistan, parts of Turkey, Kazakhstan. Those are the lands that were open during his time. So when you divide this land between those people and everybody else comes and works in their farms, it will be like a feudal system where just a few people will be in control of everything. So Sayyidina Umar radiallahu anhu says to that, there's got to be another understanding. So he, the ayat in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talked about the distribution of al-sayt, or the distribution of the land that has been captured, he sort of read through the whole chapter down below. Because down below, it said, لِلْفُقَرَاءِ الْمُهَاجِرِينَ, for the poor amongst the muhajirin. الَّذِينَ أُخْرِجُوا مِنْ دِيَارِهِمْ وَأَمْوَالِهِمْ, those who were been driven out of their homes and their properties. The next ayah thereafter said, وَالَّذِينَ تَبَوَّأُوا الْإِيمَانَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ يُحِبُّونَ مَنْ هَاجَرَ إِلَيْهِمْ, and those who were settled in their land before them, they like those who immigrate. Those are the Ansar, basically. The Ansar who were settled before in the Medina, and they loved those who immigrated to them, and they favored them over themselves, and so on. And then afterwards in the surah, it says, وَالَّذِينَ جَاءُوا مِنْ بَعْدِهِمْ يَقُولُونَ رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا وَلِإِخْوَانِنَا الَّذِينَ سَبَقُونَا بِالْإِيمَانِ وَلَا تَجْعَلْ فِي قُلُوبِنَا غِلًّا لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. And those who came after them say, O our Lord, forgive us and forgive our brothers who preceded us to Iman. That is the Muhajirin Ansar. So Umar radiallahu anhu said that Allah had given a share of this for each and every Muslim that gets, for each and every Muslim that exists from now until the Day of Judgment. Because all of those are in Medina Ja'um and Ba'din. Those who come after them will say, Oh, our Lord, forgive us and forgive those who preceded us in Iman. Is this renewal? Is this an understanding of the an understanding that may have been subtle, that may have not been clear to the rest of the Sahaba, to the point where Bilal radiallahu anhu, being one of the greatest, he also had supporters with him from amongst the Sahaba, who supported that these were two camps disagreeing over this issue. So it has been subtle. Those Sahaba may have not been able to grasp it. But Omar insisted that this will, because he was the Khalifa, so he had the right to insist. He was the ruler and Khalifa. Had Omar really distributed this land amongst the people, what would you think of the reputation of Islam nowadays?
It would have been as bad as you, the way it
is. Yeah. So it would have looked like those people fought to be owners of the land and to have used the people of the conquered countries. And it would have also resulted in extreme social injustice, because those people, you know, like one of the Sahaba, great Sahaba who fought, for instance, and so on, he gets like, you know, one big piece of Iraq, like a city in Iraq or something, and then he dies, and then his kids inherit it, and then his grandkids inherit it. And whoever told you that his grandkids will be righteous in the first place, they may be quite crooked. So eventually the land will be under the control of people who are just, and then they will also grow up lazy. And they'll grow up like, you know, like wealthy people grow up, they don't need to work. And so on. So it would have resulted in extreme social injustice, and it would have resulted in a very bad reputation to Islam. Okay, so that is a type of sort of renewal that is istihad, you know. Now, did Omar really make something up completely? No, absolutely not. Because in Khaybar, the Prophet ﷺ did not take the land from the Jews in Khaybar and divide it amongst the conquerors. However, he left the Jews and he took a share of the fruits of the land in exchange for protection. So it wasn't like Omar makes something up that is completely new. Take, for instance, when the Prophet ﷺ forbade us from you know how the lost and found, you pick it and identify it announce it at different places that you found something valuable. If it is not valuable, you can pick it and take it, don't worry about it, because no one will come back for a dollar. So if you found the quarter in the street, you can take it, that's fine. But we're talking about something that's significant or valuable. You need to announce it. So what they used to do, they would announce it for a year, or at least make it there, kept for the original owner for a year. Then he comes back, they would announce it in front of the masajid. They would go to the person in charge of the town and tell him that we found this in case someone came by and asked, etc. So, but the Prophet ﷺ said, don't take the lost camels. Like, don't take them for identification and for announcement, but do with the sheep. So why do the Prophet say this in the first place? Like, if there is a lost sheep, the wolf can eat it. But if there is a stray camel, the wolf will probably not, you know, mess with a camel. Wolves don't mess with camels. Camels could be very aggressive. So if it is a stray camel, it can go back home. And the owner will find it. And it is a camel, so it's not like, you know, if you live in a small town, and it's not like it's going to be hiding. It's a camel. So don't take it, leave it. The owner will find it, or it will go back home by itself. Now, Uthman radiallahu anhu said, take them. take the camels. Isn't that day? When Prophet said, don't take them. Uthman said, take them. So what's the deal here? Yeah, there's more, that's like a more explanation. It wasn't about the lions and wolves. It was about honesty and dishonesty. During the time of the Prophet ﷺ, the Medina was really, as close to utopia as it gets in this world. As close to utopia as it gets in this world. But during the time of Uthman radiallahu anhu, prosperity has already arrived. The Medina has greatly expanded. A lot of people are in Medina now. It's not the hardcore Sahaba that would. It was different here. The circumstance is different. So time and place do not affect the rulings of Sharia per se by themselves. But time and place are vehicles, containers of lots of other things that will impact the Sharia. So it is not basically that times change. If times change, the Sharia was meant to be immortal. The Sharia was meant to be valid for all times. But if the time changed and brought about something that will affect this particular ruling, people are dishonest now. Times change. People are dishonest. Well, let's make Maghrib 2 rak'ahs instead of 3. Well, no. Why? But times changed here. The people have become dishonest. Uthman was afraid for those camels to be stolen. The issue here is not the wolf anymore. The issue here is that the whole camel can be stolen. How in Egypt now, they actually steal cars, and before you know it, the car has been cut up into pieces and sold in the market. So you can't really trace the car because there is no car anymore. You can find your steering wheel in some place, and you find, the right front fender in one place, and so that camel can be taken, and slaughtered and cut up and all done in just a couple of hours. So times change, and then you have this trouble of dishonesty, etc. Also, the expansion of Medina did have some effect. It has become a very big town, and things were not as contained as they were. So that is new ijtihad. Here, the new ijtihad, did it change the ruling? No, it did not change the ruling. Whenever you find a village that is small, contained, and people are honest, leave the camel. The owner will come and find it. So the ruling did not change. The fatwa changed, because the fatwa does not address the ruling in isolation from the complex surrounding factors, consequential circumstances. Not all circumstances are consequential. Like, they don't affect the ruling. Like I said, the fact that we are here in America is completely different circumstances from being in wherever you come from, or if you're from here, that's a different story, but wherever you may go and live someday. But does that change anything about how you make wudu? No. Circumstances are different, but they're non-consequential. My consequential with regard to this particular ruling. But sometimes circumstances can be consequential regarding certain rulings. Give you another example that is clearer. One from the time of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu. What do you think an example from the time of Abu Bakr? What great ijtihad was made during the time of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu? Yeah, the collection of the Mus'haf. It was Umar's idea, radiallahu anhu, but he was able to convince Abu Bakr, commissioned Zayd ibn Thabit to collect the Mus'haf. But initially, Abu Bakr, radiallahu anhu, had the same reaction that someone may have when they hear something new. And they may even think bad about that scholar who said it, because, what's this? We've never heard of it. Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu did not do this, but Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu said to Umar radiallahu anhu, how do I do something the Prophet radiallahu anhu did not? So when Umar came and said to him, I see that Allah's Qurra or memorizers of the Quran have died, in Yamana, and I think that we must collect the Mus'haf before more of the memorizers die. So Waqas ibn Ma'ud, I do something the Prophet ﷺ did. did not do. So Umar continued to persuade him until he got persuaded. So why did the Prophet this is certainly renewal here, right? This is really new. The Prophet did not collect the Quran, right? And this is the Quran, so it is not like transactions, or this is like the biggest thing. So how come Umar radiallahu anhu, how was he able to convince Abu Bakr eventually? Because during the time of the Prophet ﷺ, the Quran was being revealed, and more emphasis was placed on the meaning than the letter. The letter was protected, preserved, memorized. But more emphasis was placed on the understanding of the meaning and the application of the concept. And as long as it was alive in their chests, that does not mean that, we should not honor the Mus'haf. But there is a difference between opening a book and reading and having the Quran alive in your chest. So the emphasis during the time of the Sahaba is to memorize it, to understand it, to apply it, and there were so many of them that were memorizers, so there was no fear that it would be lost, or it would be corrupted, or manipulated. Now after many of the Sahaba died, and the battles of the apostasy, Umar radiallahu anhu felt that it was about time that we collect the Quran in one volume, or in one book. The Quran was, prior to this, written on parchments, pieces of leather, stones, etc., tablets of stones, but it was not all collected in one book. So that is renewal. Now, this is not defying the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. This is basically because during the time of the Prophet ﷺ, there was a different emphasis. During the time of the Prophet ﷺ, there was not that much need because there were so many memorizers. that we're alive all in Medina.
Okay.
So if you fast forward and take another example, the Imam Abu Hanifa and Imam Abu Yusuf and Imam Muhammad ibn Hassan, Abu Hanifa, Abu Yusuf, and Muhammad ibn Hassan are the three greatest Hanafi scholars. Abu Hanifa and his two disciples, Abu Yusuf and Muhammad ibn Hassan. If you add Zufar to them, that is the greatest four Hanafi scholars. So the greatest Hanafi scholars ever said that you cannot charge a fee for teaching Quran. Right? And that was the position of the vast majority of their contemporaries. Why? Well, there are hadith that talk about this, and there are hadith that allow that seem to allow it, and a hadith that seem to forbid it. But the scholars eventually look at the circumstances and implement the rule within the circumstances. The latter Hanafi scholars, by consensus, and that rarely happens in any madhab, the latter Hanafi scholars, by consensus, allowed the teachers to take a fee. How could this happen in the madhab? A madhab means that you have some loyalty to the founders, because that's why you're Hanafi, because you follow. It certainly does not mean blind loyalty, or at least in the correct observance of the madhab, it does not mean blind loyalty, but also it is very hard to find the consensus early on one thing and a consensus later within the madhab, same madhab, on its opposite. And it wasn't about, you know, that they found the hadith that, you know, the earlier ones did not really know about or anything of that nature. Yet, the earlier Hanafi scholars existed during a time where the teachers of the Quran were given stipends from Baytul Mal, from the government, basically, to allow them to continue to teach and to continue to preach and to continue to, you know, propagate their religion. During the time of the latter imams, they were not given a stipend. During the time of the early imams, there was more religious commitment that people would put more effort and so on in teaching for free than during the time of the latter imams. So the earlier imams looked at protecting the sanctity of the Quran by not making its teaching or education contingent upon a fee. They wanted to also, you know, they wanted to also promote and boost the sincerity, the devotion. They wanted to say that this is something too valuable too valuable to charge money for teaching it. Now, the latter imams were not really oblivious to all those great meanings. They still knew that the Quran is too valuable, is extremely valuable. However, they settled that now we have to choose between holding on to that fatwa so that we can honor the Quran and risking losing the Quran. Because the Quran still, you know, yes, it will be in books, but risking losing the Quran and the reality of the Muslims, and there will be no memorizers, there will be no scholars in the Quran, there will be those kids will, you know, if we're not giving stipends to the teachers, the government is not giving stipends to the teachers do have families, they need to look after their families, and the government is not giving them stipends, so if the teachers really look after their family affairs, the students will be lost. And if the teacher stuck to the old ways of not charging a fee, their families will be lost. And in both cases, it is unfair. So now the issue here is existential. It's not about honoring the Quran. It's an existential question. Will the Quran continue to be taught or not? And if we hold on to the old fatwa, we're risking that those teachers who will not have a stipend, they will go out and farm and trade and do things so that they can maintain themselves and their families, and no one will be teaching the Quran. Now, how did other religions manage this dilemma? You know, no, first of all, there's really not that much education in other religions than there is in Islam. They don't really teach and educate, and, you know, people don't really read the whole Bible cover to cover in their lifetime. Or a lot, most of them don't. So there's not that much education or emphasis on education and teaching in other religions. There's also the concept of monasteries, which is not prescribed in Islam, because in Islam the test is to excel inside the reality, not outside of it. Because outside of the reality, that is escaping, that's not excelling. Well, you should provide a role model for the people inside the reality. But if you escape so that you stay pure, that is basically abandoning the people, telling the people, you're continuing to be dirty. And I'm leaving you to purify myself. Whereas the true test is to stay with the people in that dirt and to show them how to stay clean as much as you can in that dirt. The second, the other thing is that Islam really forbids begging. You see how the Buddhist monks go out in certain places, that they collect food and stuff like this, so that they can maintain themselves. Well, Islam forbids this. The unfortunate thing is that, in West Africa, in some places in West Africa, some of the, not the teachers, but rather the students, they go out and beg so that they can continue to study Quran. I know countries in particular, and I know cases in particular, but that's not the issue here. It is in some places in West Africa. Well, that is not correct Islamically. And the scholars would not say to the teachers, they would not be rigid and say, let's keep the fatwa of our great imams and let's tell the teachers to go out and dig, because that would have harmed the whole deen. The concept of religious commitment in Islam is different. The concept of religious commitment in Islam is surviving the test within the reality. This is considered to be renewal, right? Because they really changed the consensus of their earlier, that's the consensus within the madhab, of their earlier imams. They reversed it 180 degrees. Because of what? Change of circumstances that were found to be consequential, not to be neutral circumstances to this particular issue, but to be consequential, because otherwise it's a dilemma. That is renewal. That is considered renewal. Now, for the fiqh assemblies, and this is the last thing, and I'll leave you, you know, because we talked about democracy in the beginning. For the fiqh assemblies, nowadays, to say that democracy in its techniques, now we will talk about who should be the ultimate supreme ruler. It's certainly Allah. But democracy as a method of governance that is applicable nowadays, a method of government that people know nowadays, would be the closest to the Islamic idea. Would be the closest system present to the Islamic ideal, because the Islamic ideal was to make the people the source of authority, source of power. Not the source of legislation, but the source of power. They are the ones that select and deselect. They are the ones that hire and fire. They are the ones that, you know, they're the ones who pay for the ruler. So they are the ones who have the right to remove him. So now polling stations and elections and so on and so forth, that would be the closest thing to what Abdurrahman ibn Awf did. Then Abdurrahman ibn Awf, when it came down to Ali and Uthman, went around, went to the markets, asked the people at the market, went and knocked on doors, asked the little girls and the older women in their homes, which Khalifa would you like? Now, did they have, you know, election, say, polling stations and election, you know, those glass boxes? And there was none in this during the time. So the modern way of reviving that concept, that idea, is through elections and through the glass boxes. That would be considered renewal. That is not innovation. That is renewal. It is the idea being applied in a different set of circumstances. That's it. That's it. That's it.